You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program, and my colleague Bob Kagan and I have a special treat today to welcome Amy Chua, the famous Tiger Mom, but more importantly for today's discussion, although it's not irrelevant to her previous writings, the author of Political Tribes, a very, very important, I think, and cogent explanation of much of what's going on in the country today. And so we are going to have a great discussion with her and you, looking forward very much to this special opportunity. And before I go any further, could you please join me in welcoming Amy to Brookings? So I wanted to begin by really just giving Amy the floor to tell us a little bit about the big themes of the book. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the book. It's gotten a very nice book launch so far, including with J.D. Vance, her former student. This is also, by the way, the woman who helped persuade J.D. Vance to write Hillbilly Elegy, because he had written some of the raw material for it in a course that she taught at Yale. And so they've had a discussion in town, and she's been around the country doing quite a book tour. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with some of the themes of what she's been talking about and writing about already. But Bob and I agreed we'd like to just hear and give you the chance to hear from her mouth a little bit of how she would summarize the big picture ideas of the book. Then I'll follow up with a few questions for both Amy and Bob, and then we'll go to you by about the halfway point. So, Amy, again, welcome to Brookings, and I'm not going to go into a more elaborate introduction, except to say one more thing, which is that I mentioned Tiger Mom, and you see I brought my props. I also brought World on Fire, which is a very important book Amy wrote 15 years ago or so, before Tiger Mom, and before, therefore, her fame in many of the morning talk shows. This was the book that really began to establish her thinking and writing as a foreign policy scholar, in which she coined the phrase market dominant minority and talked about a lot of the stresses in many other countries around the world across different sectarian and tribal lines. And I think much of the thinking that ultimately shows up in Political Tribes had its genesis in this very important book as well. So I will simply say that, as well as the fact that, as you all know, she's a professor at Yale Law School and a very, very accomplished writer across many domains. And now, my friend, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Bob. And thank you all for coming today. So I'll try to be very brief here. I originally started writing this book 3 years ago purely as a foreign policy book. It was actually to try to get away from the Tiger Mom thing and to go back to my, you know, areas of expertise of a couple books on foreign policy. So on the foreign policy side, the broad thesis is that America, in stark contrast to the British in their heyday, we tend, for interesting reasons I can go into, to think in terms of grand ideological divides, you know, capitalism versus communism, or then that was followed by democracy versus authoritarianism, and then, you know, terrorism versus freedom or something. And as a result, kind of blinded by these ideological prisms, we are spectacularly blind to the group identities that matter most to people on the ground in the countries where we're trying to help. And often those identities are not national, but ethnic, religious, regional, sectarian. And I show that this blindness to the power of this, you know, tribal identity or ethnic identity has led really to some of our greatest foreign policy debacles in the last 50 years, from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Iraq. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that we romanticize democracy. And again, there are historical reasons for that. It's been a very stable system for most of our history. But we tend to think of democracy as almost like a panacea, even for group conflict and group division. So the idea is, you know, maybe there are these ethnic and tribal divides, but if we just have elections, they will melt away. There'll be ethnic alliances, etc. So we really didn't pay enough attention to the schism between the Sunnis and Shias and Kurds. In Afghanistan, I can talk more about, we thought of the Taliban as really just a fundamentalist movement, when in fact it's also very much a ethnic movement. It was founded and established and largely populated by the Pashtuns, the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. And a lot of the development of the Taliban was they were afraid of losing their dominance in that country. So what happened is how the book came to be in its current form is last February. A month after President Trump took office, I was teaching a class that I've taught for 20 years called International Business Transactions. It's actually not just about business. I use it to talk about democracy and all this stuff that I'm interested in. And I was making a point that I've made for 20 years, citing World on Fire, saying, you know, talking about how because developing countries have political and social dynamics that are so different from our own, we always mess up our foreign policy. We just don't understand those other developing countries. So I'm reading a passage from World on Fire saying, in developing countries, under certain conditions, populist leaders with no political experience can sweep to power to the horror of the establishment, tapping into deep social resentments and, you know, racially tinged, you know, anxiety. And I stopped, and 80 people are looking at me and all thinking the same thing, which one student articulated. You know, she said, it sounds exactly like you're describing the United States. And I had been reading a passage about Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. So it was really this wake-up call for me. I had to kind of rethink things, why it is. So that's kind of a big part of the book now, that we in the United States, for the first time in our history, and we can talk more about this, are starting to display some of the dynamics that destructive political dynamics that historically have been more associated with non-Western or developing world, including ethno-nationalist movements, elite backlash against the popular side of democracy, hate mongering, erosion of trust in our institutions, and so on. And I can explain a little bit later. The book kind of explores why we are starting to see these. And I also think, and this is the last thing I'll say, that starting to see, for me, I think we're also confused. How do we get to this place? How can America look like it does right now? And when you step away and see the United States, this moment as part of a larger global pattern, not just comparing us to the far right movements in, Europe, which is what everybody does, but actually seeing us through the same lens that we review countries like Venezuela or Afghanistan or Iraq that we think have nothing to do with us, I think it actually points the way forward. I mean, the way out of this. And, I'm an optimist, believe it or not. So I think that's my nutshell.
That's a great start. I wanted to draw you out on one more big picture idea that I've heard you speak about before, and then talk a little bit about an historical perspective on how we've gotten here and how bad it's been before in our history. And I'm going to, of course, bring Bob in on that discussion as well. But when I first met you, it was about a year and a half ago. It was before Trump won.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was July 2016, and most of the people at the conference we were attending, I think, expected that Trump would probably lose. It was clear that he was going to be the nominee. But you were already worried about some trends in the United States, and you write about them in the book, and you saw some of them at Yale. And some of them were about elite attitudes towards the middle America part of the country. I wonder if you could say a word more about that.
Yeah. So there's a huge racial dimension to this. I was one of the few people at Yale not surprised by the election, actually. I mentor a lot of different students, not a lot of minority students for obvious reasons, but also a lot of conservative students. And so I've gotten to know people from all walks. And I was worried about the situation and the polls coming out because, first of all, I knew all the people working in Hillary's, you know, she's a Yale person. Yale's a bastion of Hillary support. The Brooklyn office were all my students, all my former students. I knew every last person in there. And I don't think there was a single person from a working class background or middle. I mean, it was very, first of all, who has time to take off 2 years to volunteer? I mean, there's a class dimension. But secondly, it was the fact that there was probably only one open Trump supporter in the entire Yale Law School among the students, because you just could not say anything. But underground, just quiet voices, it wasn't that there were that many more Trump supporters, but there were a lot of people whose grandparents or cousins or friends who were from different parts of the country who responded very negatively to hearing basically their sisters and brothers and parents being described as stupid, fat, racist bigots. I mean, it was very, and I could hear all these conversations that we were having. And it is a difficult, a big thing that we can talk about is I think that if you don't allow people to air their grievances and say things that, you know, we have such a vocabulary now on college campuses. Like if anybody's going to express something about immigration, I'm trained to say everything in a complete, in a non-offensive way. I know all the vocabulary. It changes all the time. You know, Latinx is not just Latino. I mean, just very complicated. All the gender thing. So I think there are a lot of people in the middle of the country. They have not met many minorities. They speak in a way that sounds offensive to us. But if you instantly brand people who start talking about immigration or worries about limits as, oh my God, you're a racist, xenophobe, Islamophobe, what I've seen is it just goes underground. And that was something that I noticed right even just on Yale, one of the most liberal places where, and I'm not saying these people became Trump supporters, but, you know, it was just a weird dynamic where I could feel like there was just all this stuff going underground and what was being reported, which is, it was just out of sync.
Thank you. I want to now talk a little bit about how we should view where we are today relative to previous eras of American history. And in some ways, this is, you know, one of the conversations I've been most looking forward to with the two of you, because I've learned over the years a lot from Bob Kagan as well about how to think about American history and some of the ebbs and flows and cycles. You write about it in the book. You talk about various places and times in our past, like the Jim Crow period, where we've had a lot of tension. This is not unprecedented in our own history, what we're facing today. But I wanted to, again, draw you out on that and then turn to Bob as well for his view. And I'm going to use one more prop with another Brookings scholar involved. E.J. Dionne wrote a book 25 years ago, many of you know, which really, you know, took him to fame. And it's called Why Americans Hate Politics. And this came after the period of the late 80s and early 90s. There was a lot of divisiveness back then. Clearly, we had a very nasty period in politics then. Clearly, we had an extremely nasty period in politics in the McCarthy era, in the Vietnam era, and Bob can talk about, and you can talk about other periods before that. So to simplify and put it as a question, how bad is today compared to the other troublesome political crises in our past?
Great. So yes, a lot of what we're seeing here, we've always had nativist movements with every wave of immigration, but I think that we are at an unprecedented moment with some unprecedented challenges. We've seen echoes of them, and this is for two reasons. First of all, because America, part of the reason we've always romanticized democracy and felt that it went together very well with markets is because we've always been a country that is, for 200 years, economically, politically, and culturally dominated by a white majority. Obviously, with white a moving target, there are certain groups that are considered white today that were not before, but that was the basic dynamic. So when you have such an overwhelmingly big majority that dominates everything, it feels very politically stable. And it's not that there's no tribalism and all this terrible group identity and identity, you know, going on. It's just that there's one dominant tribe sort of speaking and projecting and all these other groups are silent. What I say in the book is when you have a very dominant majority, all kinds of terrible things can happen, oppression, slavery, but people can also afford to be more generous. What's happened today is with the massive demographic change that we have been undergoing, with whites on the verge of becoming a minority around 2044 is what the predictions usually say. Whites are no longer going to be a majority at the national level in this country. As a result of that, and it may not feel this way to people in this room, we are at this weird situation where every group in America today feels threatened. Not just African Americans and minorities, whites feel threatened. There are a couple of fascinating statistics that I quote that I had to go double check because I just couldn't believe they were true. But you know, they're Pew, they're, you know, they're 67% of white working class Americans feel that they are the subject of more discrimination and persecution than minorities. 67% of the white working class and more than half of whites in general in this country feel that way. Asians and Latinos feel threatened. Not just Muslims and Jews feel threatened, Christians feel threatened now. You can really see that in the political rhetoric right now. With Donald Trump in the office, women definitely feel threatened. But with the Me Too movement, men feel threatened. So straights and gays both feel threatened, liberals and conservatives. And everybody views other people's claims of being threatened as preposterous. But that is exactly the point of political tribalism. And so what happens is when people feel threatened, that is when they become more tribal. Again, this is also just their studies showing this. That's when they get more insular, more defensive, more us versus them. So that's point one, what's different. Although, yes, we had that in some southern states at the state level, with whites losing their majority status. The second point, too, is something that I think is lost a lot when people just fling around these terms, white supremacy or racist country. One of the most, this goes back to the question Michael asked me before, one of the biggest changes, I think, in this country is the new white against white resentment. That is the divide between, for lack of a better term, I'll say coastal whites, urban, basically everyone in this room with me, included, you know, people who view themselves, have interacted with a lot of minorities, view themselves as tolerant, multicultural, cosmopolitan, you know, worldly, liberal, progressive. You could be Republican or Democrat, but that group, the difference between that group and the, you know, kind of Trump space, the inland or heartland whites, is so stark now that it, I've been writing about ethnicity for 20 years. I have one article, there's a 20-page footnote describing what ethnicity is, you know, the constructivist theory, all this stuff. But wildly simplifying, the divide between coastal whites and inland whites or rural or, you know, is so stark now that it's almost like an ethnic difference. There is so little interaction and intermarriage. It is actually much more likely for a Caucasian person in New York City or New Haven or D.C. to intermarry with somebody from Asia or Muslim or Africa or than it is from you know, Kentucky, actually. And it's just such a stark cultural divide. Going back to J.D. Vance's book, people look different. They speak differently, so probably find each other offensive. They eat different things, something Donald Trump has tapped into. You know, when he said he gorges on McDonald's, you know, we're all more, you know, recyclable, vegan. Dress differently, different sports. I have a section. One of my favorite chapters is on worldwide wrestling and NASCAR and all these, again, prosperity gospel, these mega churches that are huge in America that we elites, and I don't mean wealthy, just educated, we miss. And partly because we look down on them. You know, these churches where people pray for money. These are very much a part of America. And so that's the other divide, this, and I can talk about, but so I think those are the two big differences that have, when Michael raised this idea of a market dominant minority, I'll come back to that. It's a big concept for me. I used to say for 20 years that the United States didn't have one. We had all kinds of other problems. So our country was dominated economically and politically by a majority. So we didn't get, the classic case of a market dominant minority is Indonesia, where a 3% tiny Chinese minority controls 70 to 80% of the private economy and all the major conglomerates. 3% ethnic Chinese controlling 70% of Indonesia's economy. And there's all this resentment. It's very taboo when I coined this. Americans are very uncomfortable with that. It feels like, are you stereotyping? And I just document the numbers. And what I say is that when you have democracy in these conditions, it's actually very destabilizing because the majority weaponizes its vote, the poor, disadvantaged majority, and will often target that market-dominant minority. I say that that's actually what happened in Iraq, where the Sunnis, for a very different reason, were a market-dominant minority, 15% of the population. They had been long dominant, first under the Ottomans, which is a Sunni power, and then under the British, who loved to divide and rule through that Sunni minority, and finally under Saddam Hussein, who was a Sunni, who favored them. So when the United States comes in and says, let's have majority rule elections, you're giving that to the long-oppressed Shia, what's going to happen? And it's exactly what I predicted in the afterword to World on Fire, that you're not going to get peace and prosperity. You're going to get the oppressed majority using that majority power to revenge and, you know, seek revenge, payback time. And I'll just say, coming back to the United States, that with some caveats, and I just published a New York Times op-ed on this, but I think this is maybe the most interesting thing. You can start, I think we're starting to see the emergence of a market-dominant minority in the United States. It's not like other countries. We're always different and idiosyncratic. I mean, we're not an ethnic nation. But I think that you can start to see these, again, us, coastal elites, as America's own version of a market-dominant minority that breeds resentment against this, like, poor, less advantaged group. And the rhetoric, it's really weird because we're not an ethnic, coastal elites obviously are not an ethnic minority, right? We're not like a racial or we're not a religious minority. But wealth in the United States is extraordinarily concentrated, wealth and power on the coasts between Wall Street and Silicon Valley and Washington establishment and Hollywood, the media. And we are, coastal elites are, as I mentioned, an extremely insular group. With our own way of speaking, very judgmental, morally superior. And here's the piece of where Trump comes in. One of the most disturbing things about countries with market-dominant minorities is you frequently see demagogues whipping up ethno-nationalist movements, targeting that minority and saying, they are foreigners. They are not real people in this country. We are the real, you know, Serbs. We are the real Zimbabweans. We must take back our country. And because coastal elites are viewed as being pro-minority, pro-Black Lives Matter, pro-immigrants, pro-helping the poor in Africa and developing countries, it's easy, many in the heartland, there are a lot of demagogic voices that depict coastal elites as wanting to sell the country to foreigners as not real Americans. So you can see in President Trump's rhetoric, the way he came in, make America great again. He actually used a certain language. We need to take back our country. So we're at this point where it's like we're almost like two Americas with each side saying the other side is not there. That does not represent real America. Those values are repugnant to me. So that's why I think this lens of looking at other countries is actually very helpful. You start to find parallels.
Fantastic. By the way, listening to you, I think of Richard Reeves' recent book, Dream Hoarders, which has some of these same kinds of arguments about how the privileged 20% is in a different place and to some extent an isolated place in our country. I wanted to bring in Bob and really just the same question about where we stand today compared to previous periods. But I just want to remind all of you, most of you know Bob's writings very well. He's such an influential and important foreign policy voice for the contemporary debate. But whenever I hear him self-identify, he describes himself as an historian, first and foremost. And so I really look forward to how he looks back at our previous periods in history and our previous troubles. Also, I love all of Bob's books equally, but he once told me that his own favorite, the only one he really is happy with, this is the way he put it, was Dangerous Nation, which was a book that talked about how the United States got to where it was as of 1898/1900. And how a lot of the antecedents of what we've become in the superpower and the post-Cold War era could be found even back then. So I really look forward, Bob, to how you're going to describe today versus the past.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it. And it's a pleasure to be on the panel here with Amy, who I've admired for a long time. And the book is great, and I recommend you all go out and buy it immediately. You know, when the hardest thing to do from a historical perspective, looking at the present, is trying to filter out what is new and what isn't new. And it's also, you know, we tend, I think, the average prejudice is everything is new, and maybe to slight the degree to which things are. So it's a tough balance, and I don't, you know, I'm not claiming. So, but let me just make a devil's advocate case that things aren't really that new. You know, this idea that the Eastern elites are running the country and can't be trusted, that goes back to the beginning. The sense that the elites, you know, you'd think about Boston Brahmin, you know, the New York, you know, commercial community. The Eastern newspapers were dominant, and this was much resented by people in the Midwest. There's a long history of resentment against Eastern elites and a long history of Eastern elites looking down on the rest of the country as a bunch of bumpkins. I mean, you know, there's the famous New Yorker cartoon showing a New Yorker's view of America, which sort of, you know, it's flyover country, you know, on your way to L.A. And that's just, that just goes back a long way. And it's worth recalling that the United States at its very birth, there were three distinct regions that exercised independent political influence that had to come up with a bargaining strategy to deal with each other because they were considered so distinct. There was what was called the West then, which was basically out toward the Mississippi. There was the South, which was had its own distinctive quality for obvious reasons. Then there was the Northeast. And the Northeast tried to secede, and later the South tried to secede. So, you know, that the country has got a very regional... we sort of felt that had gone away. I don't know why. You know, what was George Wallace? You know, what was the segregationist Democrats in the South? I think these things don't go away. So that's one thing that I would say. It's interesting what Amy says about the panic of whites today as a minority, and there's no question that that's going on. The only thing I would have to say, though, is the whites have been panicked all the way through. I mean, Jim Crow is a panicky response. The incredible explosion of the Klan in 1920, which was, you know, its second round, which far exceeded its strength even in the, you know, in the Jim Crow era or in the post-Civil War era, that was a panicky response to the perception that African Americans were, you know, moving up and joining people who didn't want them around. And so that was also a response to Catholicism, et cetera. So I don't think it's, we shouldn't assume that the whites were, they may have been comfortable like for the first 30 or 40 years of the country. I'm not sure they were ever comfortable again. And this sort of gets back to my sort of larger point, and I'll end with this, is the one thing that surprised me about your book in talking about America is, and I even looked in the index to see if this was true, you never mentioned the Declaration of Independence. And I think the great tension in American life from the very beginning has been the tension between the stated principles of the Declaration about equality and natural rights, you know, that all men have, is the way they put it, and the fact that there is also a feeling of ethno-nationalism. So America has this completely unique notion of nationalism. In this respect, it is exceptional. You're an American because you accept the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That is what binds everybody together because it's an immigrant country otherwise. But if you, it isn't even the Constitution because as Lincoln said, and in order to make the case for fighting the Civil War, the Declaration supersedes the Constitution. It's the principles that drive it. He called it the apple of gold in the frame of silver, the frame being the Constitution. He says the frame was made for the apple wasn't made for the frame. And this was the big sort of the key element of justifying an essentially extra-constitutional war against the South. And I think this tension can be seen running through the entire era of American history. And the irony, of course, is the founders of the Republic were Anglo-Protestant men. And they assumed that Anglo-Protestants would dominate the country and that culture. They didn't think Catholics, Asians, Muslims, African-Americans, or women, for that matter, were really fit to run a democracy. But, and this was the crucial thing, because of the reason for their because of the separation from Britain, they had to declare that their rights didn't derive from the fact that they were English. They had to declare that they were universal rights that everybody had, and that's how come we can separate from the king, because he's depriving us of our rights. That, which was almost an expedient argument at the time, although I think that many of them believed it, nevertheless took on real life. And you could no longer say that the success of American democracy had anything to do with ethnicity or anything else, because everybody had these rights. And this, as I say, we've been at war over this for a long time. Now, I said I was going to end with that. I'm going to end with this, which is, I have a hard time looking at this debate that you're talking about. And this is personal, but I have a hard time regarding both sides of this debate as equal.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that we have always had people in this country, from the days of slavery to the post-Civil War era, all the way through, you know, to today, who are in a sense rejecting the principles of the Declaration, who are in a sense insisting on an ethno-nationalism. And Trump is the first president to articulate in his own way, but clearly, an ethno-nationalism, which is not about the Declaration of Independence. And I don't view these two arguments as equal. I have no sympathy for people who want to negate the basic premise on which our nation was founded. And I don't care what their beef is, even. Let alone that the whites feel that they've been overrun by the fact that others have been granted rights. That has been offensive to whites for two centuries.
Please.
Yeah. First of all, absolutely brilliant. And I don't think that I actually don't think we disagree with you. I don't think they're equal either. In fact, my concept, I don't mention the Declaration, but the concept that I want to come back to is I think that America, unique really among all the major powers, is a supergroup. And a supergroup is a country, is one that has a very strong national identity. That can bind very diverse people together. And the reason we have one is because even though the founders as individuals may have been racist, fault, whatever, the principles we have are in our Constitution and the Declaration are such that this country is ethnically and religiously neutral. That is, our overarching national identity is not ethno-nationalist. And it's very special. I'm fascinated to learn all the different reasons why, but it does not belong to any ethnic subgroup. So I totally agree with that this new thing is just virulent and un-American, not our principles. So I'm not doing, again, it's so interesting. I feel like this book, Political Tribalism, I don't pull any punches on either side. And I feel like everything that the response that I've gotten is very politically tribal. Because I am not equating white supremacy and racism. I'm not saying that, you know, the Ku Klux Klan is the same thing as identity politics. No. I'm just, there are enough people mad, and some other people are already saying how terrible the situation is, how racist everything is, how racist the country is. My response is, how do we understand how we got here? And how do we, so let's say we want to get past, let's move to where Bob wants to be, where we all want to be. How do we do that? And so I have no trouble calling out racism, these acts that should be called out and sometimes are not. But when you are talking about, let's talk about the people who voted, the 60 million people who voted on the other side. I guess maybe this is where we do differ. I think 60 million people is a lot of people. It's half the country. And it's true that many, many, many millions of them may have voted for the worst reasons. But because I've studied ethnic hatred and discrimination and stereotyping for all my academic career, I see it as it's almost the definition of a prejudice and a stereotype to ascribe characteristics and a set of traits to a large body of people that you've never interacted with or seen. So as soon as the unit starts to get better, maybe you could say that whole school is racist and bigoted. Okay, I mean, I still think you're going to miss something, or that whole town is. But once we're at 60 million, so that's my book comes at things, you know, and I notice that a lot of the books are on one side or the other. Like we are, our social media is in the grip of political tribalism. Books are either so anti-tribal, whatever, or else they're the Ann Coulter, and it's just. So I didn't want to do that. My lens is different. So I don't think I have any disagreement with Bob. Like I don't. I'm not equivalent, you know, equalizing or making any equivalence. But if you ask the question differently, which is, how did we get to this horrible moment we are with, and how do we have the next election come out maybe bet in a different way? What is the best strategy for that? And is that just to say, you know what, everybody on the other who voted that the other way is an ignorant bigot? Is that going to? I mean, I've heard that. Let's just whip up the base, whatever. But I'm, I think once we kind of look through these different lenses, like Venezuela, we're also mad. Some of the fun studies in the book are about how when we connect with a group, human beings, we see everything through the lens of that group. And sometimes we're just right. Sometimes it's facts, and sometimes it's not like when you see things through the lens of your group that every group is right in its own way. No. But we do tend to cling and want to defend. Just think of your sports team, your favorite sports team. You don't care what the umpire says. You know, the New England Patriots don't care what anybody says about their quarterback. But we also derive actual pleasure from sticking it to the other side. Little neurological lights go off, you know. And so I think we're in this moment right now where there is so much anger, justifiably, especially among minority students, women, just outraged that it's interesting to figure out how to move forward. So I think that the book is just written from a different posture. And what I was going to say was, when you move away from your tribal anger or your party anger, and look at Venezuela, which I'll come back to later, that was a big oil-producing state. It was, before 1998, I mean, we had a lot of problems, huge inequality. It is a starvation state now. It is, and that was a battle between a very sophisticated market-dominant minority and a very frustrated majority, and it was a fight to the death. It was where the two sides, the pro-Chavez and the anti, just like, I despise the other side. I have no interest in talking to them. And it was a fight to the death. And so I think, again, if you pull back and kind of look at this America through a bigger lens, I want to show that the stakes are very high. You know, let's say I agree with everything Bob said, which I think I do. I mean, just on feelings. So what? Should we just cut the country in half? I mean, should we just have two republics? Or, I mean, how do we keep the America that we have? Like, what's the step forward?
So I want to follow up with Bob, if I could, and you may want to respond also to Amy. But I know that, here's a sneak preview, I'm not going to say a lot of your forthcoming book, The Jungle Grows Back, which is not going to be out for a few months. I don't want to get you too fired up about Bob's next book.
No point selling you a book that you're going to forget by the time it comes out.
The title is unforgettable.
But I have read it in draft already. And I know that, Bob, you are worried about where we are. And actually, anybody in this room who's been reading you knows that you're worried about where America is at this stage in its democracy. And it's more than just Donald Trump that worries you. So I wondered if you could now be sort of devil's advocate of your own argument and explain why I think it's fair to say you are fairly worried yourself about the state of our country at this juncture.
Well, I'm worried because I think we're behaving the way we have in the past. I mean, it's not that I think we've necessarily embarked on a new type of behavior. I think it's that a lot of people, there are only historical frame. I mean, Amy's right, we need to have a wide frame. We also need to have a long frame. And our historical memory, well, for most people today, our historical memory goes back to about, I don't know, Bill Clinton. But For those of you in this audience, you probably remember the Cold War too. But that's what our historical memory. That wasn't a crack like the way you're taking. I remember the Cold War. But you know, America has a long history, and there's a long history that preceded the Cold War. And what I see is a country looking a lot more, you know, obviously there are major differences about what's going on, but a lot more like the country of the 20s and 30s, which was at a time before we were felt threatened by, you know, totalitarianism of a fascist variety or totalitarianism of a communist. And we really thought, you know, the rest of the world could basically go to hell and we'll be fine. And I think we are in much more of that mood, and that's my big concern. But, you know, we're also, I think, returning to a certain kind of, you know, we just forget, as Amy's pointed out, there is this long history of unattractiveness, let's say, of Americans that we tend to paper over because it all worked out. But the fact is, this kind of seething cauldron of anger, including among ethnic and racial groups, is part of American history, and we shouldn't forget about it. So the one thing I want to, in responding to Amy and in general, so for instance, the 1920 election looks to me a lot like this election. What you had was certainly a rejection of internationalism. You had a rejection of progressivism. You know, the progressives had been dominant basically since Roosevelt. So for, you know, almost 20 years, you'd had a lot of progressive legislation. A lot of changes were occurring. There were also a lot of cultural changes. Again, you had African Americans, you know, moving north in greater and greater numbers. You had scientific revolutions, which were challenging people's, you know, sense. It was challenging Christianity. I mean, if you want to talk about Christians being in a panic, they were in a panic at the time of the Scopes trial, right? And so the 1920 election, and there was also, you really had peaked sort of after a very long period of unrestricted immigration, you really had a reaction against all that immigration. And the 1920 election was, in many respects, a backlash against all this sort of progressive modern world. The difference was, and so they elected Warren Harding, you know, who was kind of a non-entity, but he was a non-entity, you know, and if you go through all the various different periods of history where you've seen these kind of mass mob movements with demagogues, in the 30s you had Huey Long and Father Coughlin, and Charles Lindbergh was very popular. But the parties never let those people get the nomination. And part of me thinks that it was the fact that the Republican Party so democratized its primary system, which it had not been the case, and which Democrat Party, after the McGovern election, had de-democratized their party system, basically lost control of the nominating process. And at any other time in history, there's no way the Republican Party would have allowed a guy like Donald Trump to get the nomination. It just wouldn't have happened. Now, people say, well, it's good that they democratized the primary system. But it isn't. There's no. And it's not because I'm not pro-democratic government. I very much am. It's that the parties are not themselves democratic entities historically. They are a party. They have a party interest. And traditionally, throughout all of American history, the leaders of the party decided who should be the nominee. And then you had a democratic system to choose among the nominees. And I think this, it's almost like a fluke in a way that you got Donald Trump instead of, you know, Ted Cruz, who I think would have been, I'm not a Ted Cruz fan, but... to say the least, but even Ted Cruz is not Donald Trump. In fact, Ted Cruz tried to be Donald Trump and failed, basically, and the real Donald Trump came along. Anyway.
Michael, can I say one thing? I now know why you asked me that initial question. You just know so much history, that's interesting. I think we just have come at things a little bit differently. Again, I'm an optimist. I see changes already. So one thing I say in the book is we're at this weird moment where there's almost nobody left championing a kind of the group transcending identity, right? For the first time, we have whites. I mean, not for the first time, but openly, more openly than in many generations. Yeah. There are conferences that are covered by The Atlantic. Well, I mean, you know, that wasn't true 20 years ago. And because of reasons I understand, the minority groups and marginalized groups are what I explain is the left's watchwords was always equality and inclusiveness for a long time. It was very group transcending during the civil rights movement. At least that was the rhetoric. But what happened, and I run through this history, is it starting in the round of the Reagan era, a lot of progressives noticed that this group blind rhetoric, you know, universalist rhetoric, was actually being used by conservatives to block affirmative action, to block any kinds of policies to correct racial inequities. So starting in the late 80s and 90s, there emerged on the left what we now call identity politics, even though it's actually been around for a long time. But it's where the left just, it's group conscious. And on college campuses today, group blindness is the ultimate sin among progressives. You will instantly be labeled a racist if you are trying to be, you know, proposing any kind of a group blindness. And I understand why. It's like you are erasing, it's Black Lives Matter. We're not saying only Black Lives Matter, but you are trying to erase and not let, you know, you're just trying to cover up the very particularized oppression experiences of these different groups. And with intersectionality, the idea is that a Latino woman's experience of is very different from an Asian woman's, is very different from a white woman's. I mean, these are, so it's very group conscious. And you're seeing this from both the right and the left. And the optimist in me, I think there were a lot of mistakes. I worked with one progressive student who, I think we were talking about the trailer park. It's a particularly something I really like in the epilogue. I quote a student whose father is actually undocumented. He's from Mexico, Mexican-American, lived in a trailer park, super poor, absolutely brilliant, as progressive as you could possibly be. And what he said is, you know, I think we made a lot of mistakes on the left. He said, we cried wolf too many times so that when the real wolf, Donald Trump, came along, nobody noticed. And what he talked about specifically is a Mexican-American. He's like, so what? You know, this whole, for him, the cultural appropriation thing. So what if they're wearing a sombrero in the restaurant? I mean, obviously some things are terrible. They're just terrible things. But let's just say a well-intentioned restaurant is serving inauthentic nachos. That's racist. If that's racist, or if everything is racist and sexist, then nothing is. So, and I saw in the special elections, if you saw, I don't know how to pronounce her name, the transgender woman who won in Virginia, I think Danica Rem is her name. I remember after the election, the social media, the news, what do you think about Bob, the candidate who opposed you, who was so horrible with the transgender bathrooms? And she was such a class act. I mean, she just insisted on talking about parking, traffic patterns, like the things that people cared about. And she said, Bob is now my constituent, and I don't attack my constituents. I serve my constituents. And so I feel like there were a lot of mistakes, and I'm not equalizing. Again, this is not to
say... I wasn't even aiming that at you.
I'm defensive because I've had this moral equivalency thing, you know, because, again, people are so upset. And I'm just... For me, it's like, how did we get here, and how bad is it? Can we get out? And I think if you look at Bob's lens, it feels a little bit more pessimistic because it's like, there's bad America, good America, we're just going to have to cycle through. I feel that America has an extremely high learning curve, that there's a lot of adjustment going on. That's kind of my where this political correctness and identity politics comes back in, and how it, I think, is a possible source of optimism, because I think people are rethinking what is the right way to project a message. And by the way, on the left, you know, I think for a different topic, but it's also in this book, I think that the progressives have made a mistake ceding too much of the American dream to the right. You know, progressives on college campuses, it's extremely important for us to expose the American dream as a sham. And this is right. Like, you know what? We keep saying we actually have less upper mobility here than most European countries. for most of our history, no huge blocks of the country could not vote, could not even be human, considered human beings. The American dream has not really, we have structural racism, so we need to have massive redistribution and institutional reform. As I say, a lot of struggling ordinary Americans of all races actually don't want to hear that. They love the American dream. They hunger after it. That's why if you look at popular culture, they're watching The Voice, The Apprentice, Desperate Housewives, Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Shark Tank. Shark Tank is so important. You know, people want. So I think there's a lot to be learned, and which is why I spend some time in the book saying that, you know, we talk about inequality in a way, but I think we miss it. We miss how the groups that matter most to people on the ground, most of us elites don't know anything about them. We don't know anything about these prosperity churches, which actually were a huge source of support for Trump. We don't know anything about, the cult of Santa Muerte is huge in this country, like 12 million. And it's described as a fringe, but a lot of those people, they have a political role, you know. So we don't really understand the lower classes very well. And we just project sometimes a kind of elitist, here's our agenda. You know, a socialism and the Bernie platform is much, much more popular among highly educated students. It's not a lot of working class Americans love capitalism. They don't. What I say a line in my book is, being anti-establishment America is not the same as being anti-wealth. Populist movements throughout most history, in Latin America, other countries, populist movements have historically been more left wing. Our populist movement, they voted in a billionaire. And I think you can start to understand there's something unique about America that, to me, once you put through this lens, I don't know, it makes sense of it.
Fantastic. I think we should go to all of you. I've got a foreign policy question, but I'm going to suppress it for now and maybe come back to it later. By the way, it's just so you know, it's a thought experiment on what we should have done in Iraq, any ideas that might have alleviated some of these concerns. But we'll come back to that. Let's start here. We'll take maybe two at a time to start, and please wait for a microphone and identify yourself before you pose your question. So we'll take these two in the front row.
Thanks. I'm Peggy Orchowski. I'm the congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook. I've written two books on immigration, and I really agree with you about the 1920s when you look at the 1920 Immigration Act, how it changed in the 60s that we got what we have, and now we're going back to a more restricted idea of immigration. It really fits that. But in that context, I want to ask you about citizenship and the challenge to the whole idea of a sovereign nation state. I think that lies behind a lot of this, that you say you can't look at a big group, and in the past, being an American was the thing that resolved that identity politics, the Americans going to war, the Americans, you know, embracing civil rights. And it does. If being an American, being a citizen, which is different, having citizenship has different rights than an immigrant has. If you can't even talk about American citizenship, that to me is the main way you're going to solve this, that kind of unity.
Okay, thank you. And one over here, please.
Yes, thank you. This discussion, I think, is fast.
Could you identify yourself?
Oh, yes. Sorry. I'm Ted Bender. I think of the conversation here linking up with a recent book by Robert Reif called The Common Good, where he articulates principles of democracy as promoting the common good. And he's a perfect speaker, as well as the people up here. He described an anecdote where at the airport, somebody recognized him as a public figure and just walked up and said, "What do we do now?" So I'd like to ask the people up here, could you articulate more or focus more on what do we do now? And this dovetails into this comment about citizenship.
Great. Thank you. Amy, you want to start?
Yeah, I don't think I quite may not fully understand the question about citizenship, but I'm just going to tie it to immigration, which is I think this is a very, very difficult issue. I'd be curious to know what Bob thinks. Yes, I remember the 1920s and this, you know, and some people think that we actually need to go back to have assimilation occur. I'm not going to answer. What I want to say is that I am the daughter of two immigrants. I'm a huge fan of immigration. My second book, Day of Empire, was all about how immigration has been our lifeblood and what vaulted us to being a great power. So I'm a huge immigration fan. But I will say that if you look at some of these studies I cite, something very interesting has happened to views about immigration in this country. These are all new. It used to be much more of an overlap between Republicans and Democrats. If you had a Venn diagram, a lot of people kind of in the middle, not sure. Right now, the views among Republicans and Democrats are so extreme now. And it's not just that they're separate from each other. The left is way more left on immigration. I don't know if it's quite open border, but it's much more, it's just much more open to the idea of immigration without, and not strong on restrictions. And then the right is way crazy, shut down. I mean, it's just much more polarized. So I don't know what's going to happen, Bob. You're right about these trends, but you're right about the 1920s and the act and everything, but we do have changing demographics now with much more political power among minorities and non-whites. I'm curious to know. I mean, I think a lot of minorities who hate the disease of whiteness have told me, I've actually taught what next, and like we need to get as many immigrants as possible to root out the disease of whiteness in this country. Okay, this is how virulent the language is becoming on all sides, you know, and I'm not in that camp, you know, because we have nothing. So I think, first of all, having said that I'm a huge immigration fan, that, again, I think we made mistakes. I think we need to be able to talk about this. Immigration is a very difficult issue. I don't think we're having any conversation at all, actually. I think it's more of a gotcha. We're just name-throwing. You know, as soon as anybody starts to say anything like, you know, but if you're, you reveal yourself as a conservative, you say, but, you know, should the immigrants all come from this country? What kind of rules should there be? What about illegal? Oh, you know, certainly on a college campus, you can't use the term illegal. If you don't have people who are, especially in the middle of the country, I know Bob takes a bleaker view of them, but I'm more sympathetic. I think that you can be a person in the middle of the country who has never interacted with a lot of Asians or African-Americans or Muslims, who is worried about the changing face of the country, that they see the Grammys and the Oscars, they're worried, they feel they're losing their country. I feel that that can be consistent with not being a horrible racist. Or if it is a racist feeling, that by talking and persuading exposure, we can change them. That is, I think it's a natural human instinct to worry if you're suddenly seeing something unfamiliar. And to instantly say, you can't talk about it, you're racist, it drives it underground. And that's what I see, and I'm so worried about. I think if you don't talk to people, don't try to persuade, don't try to interact, it all goes underground. And that's where the ugliest part of America is. And that's what turns me a pessimist. You should see these emails I get. I mean, I cannot believe it. The anti-minority, anti-Semitic, and I'm hoping they're just fringe people. So I feel like they're good. They're terrible people. Then I feel there are people who are just worried, you know. So as to what to do, this is going to sound very Pollyanna, but my favorite studies in this book are, they're actually quite a lot that show that if you can pull people out of their tribes and have them interact as human beings, huge progress can be made. This is different than just saying more diversity or more exposure. The studies actually show the opposite. If you put just a lot of diverse people together, that can actually lead to more hatred and division. You literally have to have two people, pull them out of their groups, have them interact. So you take a Trump, somebody voted for Trump, somebody against, and put them together and have them talk about their children or pets, dogs, you know, or sports or something. And the one great example I describe is the integration of the military in the 1950s. When they proposed that, it was no. Public opinion, the military, no. when they did studies after they did it, they found that the effectiveness of those integrated groups was as equal to or superior to the all-white groups. And when they interviewed people, it was amazing. It wasn't just black and white. I mean, Swedish Americans had never met Mexican Americans and never met Italian Americans. But what they said is, when you all are sleeping in the same quarters, dealing with the same issues, when you put your lives in other people's hands, it doesn't matter the color of their skin. It doesn't matter. Attitudes towards same-sex marriage, same thing. 30 years ago, 90% of Americans opposed. 90%. 30 years later, that's a very short time, a strong majority in favor. Why? Ruth Bader Ginsburg put it well. She said, it's when people started realizing that this faceless group was their child, their cousin, their neighbor, their friend, their colleague. And once you humanize it, people actually become, enormous progress can be made. So I wrote this op-ed, I mean, the Washington Post thing, I heard about this Better Angels thing, which is trying to bring people together. I have this huge student group that it's students. They're Generation Z. I don't know which. They are, you guys all messed it up, but our generation wants to reach across the divide. We have a bipartisan thing. So I feel, I know it sounds like not a very good, usually we like policy proposal from the, but I think we need to have a collective will to want to do it. I always liken this to every one of us has had been in a fight with a significant other or a child or a friend, and you say, you know, I'm really trying, but you know deep in your heart that you're still just furious, you know, that you're really, I think we all know the difference when we're really trying to, to reach out to the other side or when we actually just want to hurt them more. I'd like to think that we're, you know, because I think that there is no hope if we just, If we get to a point where we view the people who voted on the other side as not just people that we want to disagree with and debate, but literally as immoral enemies who are not America, we are really in danger of a fractured country.
Bob.
Just a couple things. I mean, one is it's not a prescription, but it's about avoiding extremes. I mean, immigration, for instance, the country's allowed to control the flow of immigration. You can be more open to immigration or less open to immigration, but ultimately immigration policy is the consequence of a debate between people who are more open and less open. So I don't like this idea that, you know, you're not allowed to say anybody's an illegal immigrant. I also don't like the idea that we're going to go back to the 20s and have, everybody come from Norway. And if they're not an insult, I love Norwegians, and I'm not saying I don't want more of them. But, one little anecdote. The immigration legislation of 1924, which was the most draconian in our history, made one person very nervous, and that was Adolf Hitler. Because he was worried that the United States would become the Aryan nation before Germany could become the leading Aryan nation. So he was very troubled by that. But, you know, in terms of what to do, I have a kind of objective optimism, which is that if you look at America's history, despite all the attempts to push it back, despite all the ethno-nationalist tendencies and everything, the Declaration has actually always won in the end.
Yes.
There's one consistent pattern in America from the very beginning, which is the continual expansion of protected groups, including what Amy was just talking about. Once a group designates itself as needing protection, sometimes the court says no, but it's amazing how eventually, almost invariably, and to a point where now we have rights crossing over each other and clashing into each other, but that's the trend. And the bottom line is, you could talk about ethno-nationalism and white nationalism all you want. America can't go there. It can only go to the universalist nationalism of the Declaration. There's no other place for Americans to go and it still be a country. So I think ultimately we get back on track. I don't know exactly how, but we have in the past. Sometimes it required a civil war. It's a minor problem. But in the case, though, I have to say, honestly, I would say the most important thing we need to do right now is to defeat Donald Trump. Because, and I'm not saying that, yeah, hold your applause. because, you know, America is a big a clash of movements and ideas, etc., but it is also a political system in which the winner of the political battle sets a tone for the nation. I think it is clear that even from the time when Trump got the nomination, people felt more willing and able to say what they really think after having felt that they were shut up all this time. Since he's been president, things have gotten worse. If you had a president who was trying to tamp down this stuff instead of every day trying to fuel it, I think we'd be moving at least back toward keeping these things under wraps, not under wraps, but under control. And I just want to say one thing. I like the idea of everybody should be able to express everything they feel, except that that's like a disaster. I mean, one of the good things about, I believe that political correctness has gone to some absurd extreme, especially on the campuses, but political correctness is a good thing also. I don't want people expressing their racism freely as a way of healing our problems. It's not going to heal it. You know, it's going to make things worse. You know, it's dangerous, too. Before World War I, there were interesting polls taken about whether America should be neutral or not. In areas of high German-American concentration, there was very high support for neutrality, well beyond the German-Americans. And a lot of that had to do with they had German-American neighbors, didn't want to offend them. You know, there was a lot of, we have to get along with these people. As soon as we got in the war, and people felt free to express what they really were thinking about German Americans, a lot of really ugly and violent things happened. So there is something to be said for telling people, keep it to yourself.
I'm just going to add one point before we go to your next round of questions. You just heard a conservative say that defeating Donald Trump needs to be our top priority. I don't disagree with Bob necessarily, but I want you to hear a Democrat say that I think having a better vision for the economic future of the middle class should be our top priority. And I'm concerned that the political debate is actually not promoting bipartisan attention to that question, even though I think there was a bipartisan message in 2016 that that's what voters need. And I've got a few Sanders friends in the crowd, so forgive me for getting him wrong, but I heard a lot of a strong economic message from Sanders, which is part of why this 74-year-old socialist from Vermont could actually keep defeating Hillary Clinton in primaries, even after she had wrapped up the Democratic nomination. The party voters didn't really want the de-democratization of the party to go to the point of, you know, Hillary being anointed before she had actually had to deliver a strong economic message of her own. And we know that there are amazing statistics that back this argument up, and I won't go through them in any kind of great detail, but one by, that's been highlighted in the 1930s and 40s, if you were from a working class or middle class family, you had a 90% chance of ultimately living better than your parents. That's sort of one way to define the American dream. Today, that figure is less than 50%. And that's a stark change in our country. The direction in the basic well-being of people in different quintiles, the 60% and below, are just not doing that well. And it's not just about financial means. It's also about sense of purpose, sense of career longevity, sense of loyalty from your employer. There are a lot of things wrapped up in that. And I think that fuels some of the anti-immigrant resentment when people feel, rightly or wrongly, that some of the new arrivals are taking their jobs. So that would be my own personal answer. But let's get back to you. Let's go to the back part of the room this time. So we'll go all the way to the back and then, yes, please, the woman in the white blouse, and then we'll take one more.
Yang Le Yun, Foundation for Empowerment. I was a former senior economist at World Bank. I'm not an American. I have lived in this country more than 30 years, but as a Korean, as a foreigner. So my observation here, Amy, is that, you know, you are really lively, and not only Tiger Mom's popularity, it's just really exciting. And then I have two questions. Even though I have many questions, I limit myself to questions. First, you said that the America is not special. It is part of the other. Sort of, this is a trend, world trend, like Venezuela and other things. As a development economist, I understand why Venezuela was in that situation, all these things. I would rather think that, yes, this is not only special in America. This is a world trend in advanced countries, especially Europe and all democratic countries. since 1945, 70 years, it has been very, very special thing. Now it is a sort of like, okay, which kind of democracy we should have? There seems to be a struggle in every country. So I would rather strongly ask you to really think of America as part of the advanced countries, and the other countries as actually should look after take after these countries. And then how, the second question is that...
I'm just going to hold you to one, because we got to keep moving. Okay. Thank you. Let's take one more up front.
I give it.
Okay. Yeah. Let's take one more up here. There was a hand about in the 10th row that I saw just a second ago. Take one more question before we come back to the panel. Okay, anybody? Okay, we'll come back. So the gentleman here in about the 5th row, please. Behind you, and thank you. We'll take both of you, actually, and then we'll go back.
Thank you. My name is Peter Gluck. I wanted to come back to Robert Kagan's point toward the end of his comments about the Republican Party would never have nominated Trump, but I think you could say the same thing about the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, I don't think, ever ran as a Democrat. And would you agree that the sort of the history of that could go all the way back to the McGovern Commission reforms that allowed McGovern to be the nominee in 1972?
We'll take this last question, and then we'll come back to the panel.
My name is Michael Measy. I wonder whether, to some extent, Amy is setting up a straw person, I'll use that term, in regard to the 60 million people or so who voted for Trump. We, you know, a lot of those votes, probably, you know, three quarters or more, are what Alan Abramowitz and his colleagues refer to as a result of negative partisanship. People are voting Republican because they're not going to, they're called yellow dog Republicans in some ways. They'll vote for anybody who's a Republican. And maybe we're sort of talking too much about, we need to address the disenchanted working class, upset white male, but they're not, I don't think anybody's calling all of those people who voted for Trump, deplorables and so on and so forth. That's not what's happening.
Okay, so Amy, over to you for whichever of those you'd like to address.
Just very quickly, I think you're... I just take the point. I couldn't quite get the whole question about America being special, but I think I'll just accept that. I actually do think America is special. I'm just saying that we're starting to display some of these dynamics, and I understand why. Like, it's a very... When you have a certain resented minority and a bunch of people who feel... left out, that they're losing their country for racist reasons or whatever reasons, it's very common to see the rise of demagogues in these conditions. I'm going to use this opportunity to introduce the big concept in the book about I do think America is special. When I said supergroup, and I think this actually gets us out of this pointless fight about identity politics with everybody pointing fingers at the other side and then saying that we should stop it. I mean, my first words in the book are humans are tribal. You can't, some of these group identities that are now finally being expressed are incredibly important. They are the groups that were formerly suppressed. So you can't just get rid of identity politics. But I think that America is special because we are a supergroup. That is, it is actually very rare to have both a very strong overarching collective identity. And the second requirement of a supergroup is it has to be a country that allows individual subgroup identities to flourish so that you can be, I'm Croatian American or Libyan American or Korean American, and very patriotic at the same time. So China is not a supergroup. China is incredibly powerful, but it's got the first requirement, but not the second. That is, it has a very strong national identity, top-down, it's an ethnic nation, but it doesn't let groups like the Uyghurs and the Tibetans and all these, it suppresses those. And interestingly, even France, who seems so similar to the United States, I argue is not a supergroup. Again, it has a very strong, overarching national identity, but it has this almost, because of laïcité, people are, minority groups are not allowed to wear the headscarf. There was the burkini ban. And a lot of people, the President Sarkozy said, this is the French concept of laïcité. If you want to be a French person, you have to eat like a French person, dress like a French person, talk like a French person. And many But we're different than that. So I, you know, I think that we have actually the apparatus. It is actually related to the Declaration of Independence, because that overarching national identity has to not belong to any particular groups, but it has to exist there. So you can have these sub-tribalisms, subgroup identities, but we can't only be about our tribes, which is why I think I keep wanting to find that connective tissue, because I think that's what makes America special. And in this moment of anger, it's very easy to not want to do that, to figure out what it is that can bind us all. And I'll say this is where the progressives have it right. I think the right thinks of itself as the champions of the big national identity. But having a strong American identity is not just a matter of singing the anthem very loudly and waving the flag. And if you really want a very a national identity that resonates for all the people, or, you know, that can bind us together, the system needs to be perceived as legitimate. If you want to ask groups to buy into this idea of America as a great country, you have to treat marginalized groups, smaller groups, with the same dignity and respect, and not shoot them more in the back. So it's this project of having a big national identity that connects us all is not just about flag waving. It actually, there's just a lot of work to be done. So I don't know. Again, I feel like with these concepts, I see the way forward. And I happen to think that people are moving in those directions.
Robert.
In no particular order. I mean, you're arguing that the McGovern reforms were what kept, that allowed Hillary to get nominated, right? Right. Well, I guess I just feel I wasn't thinking about obviously Sanders running as a socialist in the Democratic Party, but I was mostly thinking about the fact that the Democratic Party, by creating these superdelegates, stacked the nomination in Clinton's favor, because it was a little like. It was some little part of smoke-filled back rooms plus, you know, democratic process. So I just think that the Republican Party has went in the opposite direction. The Republican Party was sort of where the Democratic Party was in 1972 in terms of having, having really no check on what the primary voters did. I forgot what the other questions were. No, remind me. What was it?
There was an immigration. There was a special question.
Oh, and what was your question again?
The 60 million are not all.
Oh, right. I mean, the thing to say about the election, sorry, I'm getting old. The thing about the election is that, first of all, 99% of Republicans voted Republicans and 99% of Democrats voted Democrat. Now, some of us were surprised by that only because if you viewed, as I did, Donald Trump as being, there is no question to which the answer is Donald Trump, whether it's middle class or, you know, and so that was my prejudice. And a lot of us in our East Coast snobbery, although Donald Trump is also from the East Coast, felt that this guy, whatever else you want to say, this guy should not be president. The interesting thing is 99% of Republican voters thought, why? What's the problem? And, of course, as you say, they also said, and, boy, you know, between this Hillary Clinton, et cetera, you know, we're not voting for her, so, and he's fine. And that, to us, you know, who thought he wasn't fine, that was the big shock. But otherwise, the election turned on a few tens of thousand votes in Wisconsin and a few tens of thousand votes in Pennsylvania, most of which, by the way, could have been made up for a higher black turnout, which didn't happen, which says to me that African Americans are behaving more like a normal ethnic group. They're really mostly interested in whether one of their guys is running. Otherwise, they're sort of semi not interested, and they didn't see it as an existential threat enough to come out in those numbers. But I think, you know, again, so then you have to decide. So what was it that swung that? And the only thing I would say is we just don't know. And I'm sure historians can be arguing this forever. If you named a generic, I'm going to just pose for you a campaign. A versus B. 1 week before the vote, the director of the FBI is going to say that A may be under criminal investigation. Who would you say was going to win that election? So, who knows what this was all about? There were a lot of moving parts in this election.
We have time for one more round. And so I think we'll go right here in the fourth row. Just take these two questions right next to each other here in the fourth row. And then we'll have to stop, I'm afraid. Wrap up.
My name is Joan Neal, and I am with Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice. And my question is, what is your definition of what an American is?
Okay, and then gentleman next to you.
I'm Fred Altman, I'm retired, and my question is, could you interpret the East Coast, West Coast as urban versus much less urban? And the fact that the country's becoming more urban will help to solve these problems.
And since you two are so cogent and crisp, we'll go to one more here, and then we'll wrap up together. So please, here in the front row.
Hello, I'm Marina Fazel, an African-American journalist, and I would like you to try and put your comments in context of what is going on with the allegations about Russian interference. Because, as someone who is American and yet I have an Afghan identity, I watch all of this, and it seems that in the context of all of this, two questions constantly keep coming back to me. To talk about identity politics and put it in the context that you have put and you're talking in your book, at the same time, it seems that the main question should be, is this democratic system credible and viable for the major population in the United States? And if you do have some of your adversaries trying to influence your internal politics, which would be totally natural, especially an adversary that you've had rivalry with for over 7 years, shouldn't there be more focus on reassuring the public, both domestically and globally as a democratic leader in the world, that your democracy is intact? And while all the different organs continue to talk about this, and we still wonder whether there's an interference in your internal politics, this unfolds, but is that a sign of strength of democracy or a sign of it totally being held hostage in you, whether by design or default, being divided among your different sectors?
Very good. So, Amy, would you like to have first or last word?
I'll say first. I'll keep it short because actually some of these questions I think Bob may know more. Well, the FBI. Just to the last question, I'm not an expert on, countries try to interfere with people's elections all the time, and this is a terrible situation. Somebody should be doing something about it. It's outrageous. I'm not an expert on that, but it's dire, obviously. All I will say, though, is it goes back, why is it effective? It's effective because we're tribal. The Russians took stuff that was already, they took stuff that's out there, right? They're tapping, it's not like they invented it. That we have these divides, there is this virulence, and then they magnified it. So, but it's terrible. This needs to be addressed, and it's an emergency, the integrity of our electoral system. What is an American? I could go, I just go back to, I think, I end the book with actually my favorite, Langston Hughes's book. America is aspirational. America, it goes back to the Constitution and the Declaration. We have never been the country we said we were. But I think it's aspirational. So I think of America just simply as somebody, we have the Constitution, we have rules, but who subscribe to the values of our Constitution, which, by the way, we have repeatedly and shamefully not lived up to, but we, as Bob says, we try to move forward. I also, embedded in that same fact, think that my book is very comparative. Most countries in the world are ethnic nations or more ethnic nations. Like the China is mostly filled with ethnic Chinese, speaking ethnic Chinese. They're dominant, Korea, mostly Koreans, ethnic, whatever. Even Poles or German, they may now try to be more multicultural, but they originate as ethnic. Bob is right. We were founded by mostly Anglo-Saxon Protestants, but we started earlier with this kind of many, many religions. And our constitution was not, interesting to know the reason why, you know, related to England. I didn't know that. But our Constitution was never only Anglo-Saxon, you know, we had three-fifths, I mean, it was not perfect. So I think that it's extremely important part of our identity that that we're not an ethno-nationalist country. So here, Bob and I could not agree more, that we that to the extent that we have leaders and president that is pushing us in this direction is just un-American and counter to our principles. I think the East Coast, West Coast thing, I sort of am thinking of the West Coast as, maybe I'm just blinded. I just got back from LA and San Francisco. I think of them as very urban too. So I think you're maybe thinking of Washington State and Seattle, or when you say rural.
No, I was just saying you could explain those effects by urbanization.
I see. Yeah.
Very urban.
Interesting.
Country, there are some exceptions,
yeah.
But mainly rural.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, going back just to end, I'm with Michael. In terms of what should we do to get out of this, if you look comparatively, you see zero-sum political tribalism when it feels zero-sum. You know, when people can rise and get out of it and they don't feel they have to eat each other up for it, that they're not competing for limited spoils. And it's not just that we used to have much more upward mobility, and maybe this goes back to a response I would have had to one of Bob's earlier points. We have way less, you're right, though, relative to when. But compared to, say, 30 years ago, we have less geographic mobility right now. One of my colleagues is writing about how the coasts are so expensive now. Used to be you could go to a public, education used to be a much greater equalizer. You could go to a public high school in the middle of the country, do pretty well at a state college, make it enough to get to New York or San Francisco. It's impossible to pay rent now. Education is out of control. Tuition is so high. All this tutoring stuff. You know, even we can't even afford it. How can somebody from a blue collar family in the middle, you know, get to a top university? And then you can't afford to even live in these cities. So again, I've colleagues, and I think Brookings is doing some stuff like that too. Just how can we change tax policy, finance policy, urban planning policy to not have the situation where people can't even be mobile across the country? That rigidifies this. The two Americas, like if people can't even interact. Oh, is this my last thing I get to say? Okay. One pet project that I have that I actually thought of, and I didn't put it in my book, but as I've traveled the country, people like this. What if, you know how our kids have gap years? It's a big thing. After high school, they go, and mostly it's a pretty privileged thing. They often go to like Australia or the Netherlands or Guatemala, and often with their own friends. So they're actually in the same group. What if, I don't know if it's mandatory or whatever, what if children after high school or even within high school from one part of the country went to another part of the country where they traditionally would never otherwise have gone, and were forced to interact with each other on a common project, not as one group condescending to the other, let me teach you and help you, but like on a common endeavor. I think that would be a great plan. I mean, a lot of our kids are just staying in their own bubble as they go to Australia anyway.
It's busing.
Yeah. Yes, well.
That worked out great.
I have hope.
Bob.
Are you going to go back to Amy again?
No, I'm done.
Well, we'll give her a choice and a chance.
Oh, okay, because I don't have the last word. I shouldn't have the last word. You should have the last word.
No, but you have two tough questions.
I don't have two tough questions. We are still open to Russian attack in the way we have been because the Republican Party doesn't have an interest in stopping it. And so they control both houses in the White House, and so we're not going to do anything about it. That's the reality of American politics. Isn't it wonderful? In terms of what it means to be an American, I mean, you know, we have the lowest bar to what it means to be a national of our country, of any country in the world. I mean, Amy's right. In France or Germany, you know, a Turk could live in Germany their whole life. They could be born in Germany, but they'll never be German. In the United States, if you follow the laws and pursue changes in the law through the accepted constitutional effort, instructions, then you're an American. That's it. You don't even have to believe, you know, I personally would say you ought to believe in the principle of Declaration of Independence, but that would wipe out, you know, huge swaths of Americans over history. So I can't really insist that that is one of the prerequisites. It's really, you know, it really is. I think in obeying those laws and respecting that Constitution, there does get created a certain commonality of values. You know, you take people from El Salvador who live in one kind of way in their home country. They live in an entirely different kind of way in the United States. And I remember having immigrants from Central America tell me, you know, this is what they love about America. If they follow the law and they pay their taxes, they're left alone. I mean, that is the great gift. So. Right, and then we passed other laws which negated those laws. I mean, Amy's right. Obviously, I don't tell me about the flaws in the American system. It's just a question of, to be an American, all you have to do. I mean, look, we had a constitution that was written with slavery built into it, and well, we had to fight a war to deal with that. But you know, but then we spent another 100 years fighting back against all the efforts to deprive African Americans of their rights. We're still not there, but we have been fighting, and mostly successfully through normal constitutional practices and elections. That's all you could say. I mean, all I'm really saying is you can't lead an armed revolution against the government. That's all, you know. Other than that, it's free reign. That's what American system provides. It doesn't mean you win, but it means that that's the chance that you have.
I'm going to stop it there. I'm going to wrap.
Yeah.
When one person says, I'm an American, and another person says, I'm an American, there could very well be, and there are, huge differences in what they mean.
Yeah. I want to say one last thing by way of advertisement for the book, which you can find just outside the door. Dave Petraeus and Stanley McChrystal both endorsed this book, which is quite interesting, given that Amy was critical of what we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, this speaks to the character of Petraeus and McChrystal, who are open to constructive criticism. But also, I wanted to come back to this one last theme in closing, because when Amy showed me the book a couple months ago, I was mesmerized, and I said, the only criticism I have, I think you were a wee bit too harsh on the efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. And what I meant by that was not that she was wrong, but that building a sense of Iraqi identity or Afghan identity is even harder than building on this sense of American traditional identity. And in a society that's been so fractured for so long, you've got to do multiple things simultaneously. You've got to have a leader who somehow rises above the fray. You've got to create systems of constitutional checks and balances on different institutions. You've got to create a legal system, perhaps out of nothing, that protects the individual. And you've got to have major political parties that are cross-sectarian in their basic orientation. You've got to do all those things. And if any one of them fails, the mission will probably fail. And so that's the only reason why I thought that, in fact, we didn't go into these missions quite as blind, or we learned pretty fast, but the task is so daunting, which is part of why I think she's ultimately correct about why this challenge needs to be remembered here as well, because human beings just don't innately behave in this way. And as much as this dialogue was very good that you just had, and as many flaws as we do have in our system, the notion of being an American is somehow a little bit stronger than in most countries around the world. We should let you make sure that you don't have one last thing to say, and then we'll wrap up and thank you for being here.
No, this was a wonderful discussion, and we can maybe have a smaller discussion with individual people. Thank you for coming. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Amy.